everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Bog right here on Dave Martell channel, which you should like, subscribe, share, click the little alert button so you can go to alert every time we go live, which is every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern with me and Tristan every single week, bringing you all kinds of awesome stuff, digging into the Eddas, digging into the mythology, digging into whatever comes out of our minds that we're going to share, talk about wisdom, spirituality, science, everything. We're all over the place. It's a lot of fun. So, like, subscribe, share, click the little bell. I know everybody's having trouble with the YouTube alerts. I know YouTube's up to no good. They've been up to no good for a while, but it's okay because I have, we have some contingency. So I'm going to put, I have a Telegram channel that I use to send out an alert every time I go live, just in case you don't, just in case you guys don't do it. I see people piling up in the chat. Hail everybody, many blessings everybody. But before we get started, we got a really good, cool show tonight. We're going to talk about the afterlife, the components of the soul, the journey of the soul. So much awesome stuff. You guys are going to absolutely love it. But before we get started, like always, shout out to my homegirl, Miss Hannah, traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Stop giving your money to the international vampires. They hate your guts. They sell you poison. They absolutely do. Plastics, synthetics, all kinds of weird chemicals, trashes your hair, trashes your body, trashes your skin. She's got so much good stuff, everything from body lotion, conditioner, shampoo, facial toner, beard oil. Look at my beard. I have a beautiful beard. So, man, she's got so much great stuff there. So make sure you keep your wipe bright, keep your beard robust, and keep your mane flowing just like Big Dave. Traditionalapothecary.bigcartel.com. Promo code Dave to get 10% off. You guys are going to love it, I promise. So anyway, Mr. Tristan, how are we doing tonight, sir?
Well, I'm doing just fine, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great. It's good to be back. I always look forward to our episode of The Bog here because it's like it's my time to unwind and have a little bit of fun. You know what I mean? I don't go to the bar or do anything like that anymore. So doing the podcast is like my time to cut loose. I really like it.
Cracking a few of the Eddas open with the boys.
Yeah, that's it. Cracking the Eddas with the boys. So, Mr. Tristan, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Well, tonight we're going to discuss the soul complex amongst the Germanic people, and also where the soul goes when you die. What is the afterlife amongst the Germanic folk?
Sure. And this is, in my opinion anyways, this is a topic that gets overlooked a lot in modern Ossetru and heathenry. Not so much Setianism. Us Setians are very big on these kind of like eschatology and cosmology and stuff like that. But in the past, in my opinion, a lot of the times, like, you know, pagan groups or whatever would overlook this kind of thing, which is very, very, very important. And when we look at, you know, what our ancestors believed, you know, what's more important than what happens after you die? Like, you know, No, doesn't matter if you are like us, you're a very devoutly faithful person, or if you're just kind of like an agnostic exploring different things or whatever, everybody and their brother is concerned about what happens after we die. You know, even just curious, what happens after we die? Because, you know, I guess, what happens to the soul? What is our soul made of? Do we have a soul? Like, these are questions that every human being asks. And in my opinion, in the past, you know, up until recently, at least anyways, many of our people that are, you know, heathen, pagan, Ossetru, Odinist, whatever you want to call it, really overlooked this. And this was like a part that was, they're like, oh, well, it's kind of up for interpretation or whatever. But it was not up for interpretation to our ancestors. They had a very stern belief on it. I mean, obviously, it's multifaceted and it's complex and there's a lot to it. But they did believe in an afterlife. They didn't believe that we were meat machines. That's an entirely modernist concept, that we're just meat machines.
Right, absolutely. And I can understand why modern heathens would be reluctant to discuss the topic, or even, unsure of exactly what they think on the matter, because it's not like some other things. For instance, like, what is the description of Valhalla? You can find that on, you know, 1,000 different places. You can't really find what are the contents of the soul and what they are made up on book, on, you know, page 3. It requires a lot of in-depth research and some speculation. Some, you have to use some logical analysis here. And that's something we're capable of. We can do that, especially us with the Sethian faith. That's our thing here. That's what we do. We're going to construct the sources we have to something we can use in the present.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's obviously it's a question that I've always had, and I see people in the chat saying this is something I've always been wondering about our faith, and it's something we're going to really dig into tonight. So let's get right into it, Mr. Tristan. Let's start with you have it here in our show notes talking about the various parts of the soul, or not just the soul, but of the being. And as we know, and there's Platonic schools, and even the Greeks. I had a show pretty recently with Miss Sydney, who's a Hellenist or Hellenismos, and they believe very staunchly in the idea of the tripartite soul and the soul components. A lot of people don't realize we have a very, very similar concept as the tripartite soul. And Mr. Tristan, can you tell us about this, like the different aspects of soul, the soul components and being and stuff like that?
Absolutely. First, we're going to have to start with the homer, which is the shape of the body. It's literally in Old Norse, it means the skin or the covering. And the homer is the part aspect of the soul that creates the physical form. Mm-hmm. Now, to understand how our ancestors conceptualized this, you have to realize that they weren't just talking about the crude physical matter of this is your body and you poke it with a spoon and it's physical substance.
Yeah.
But they were also thinking of the way your body is perceived by others in the mind's eye, your perception of them. So when you see, for instance, indications of like shape shifting, like Bodvar Bjarki, he turns into a bear, aspects of that, and berserkers and that sort of thing in the Germanic sources. These are people who are manipulating the hammer, the spiritual essence of their body, in order to produce these effects.
Really? That's really. And just us beginning to talk about this, it kind of throws out the idea that our ancestors, those that practiced the Germanic tradition, were these like mindless barbarians that had no deeper thought or nuanced spiritual understanding.
Yes, and actually that's a reasonable thing to put up here. I've always said that the depth and complexity of our lore and our spirituality itself proves that this must be of divine origin. Because most of our ancestors, when you go far back enough, these people were barely literate. I mean, the Jarls were literate, people, priests, that sort of thing, who had cause to actually use letters and whatnot. But, maybe 20 people in a group, 25, couple dozen more, and for large areas in Germania. And that's what these people believed. You simply can't come up with this on your own in the woods somewhere. It shows that this is the teachings of gods.
And it also shows that our ancestors, our Germanic ancestors, were civilized people. They weren't, ooga booga living in mud huts. And
Right. I actually think it's a bad dichotomy to think of everything in the terms of barbarism and civilization. You have to realize that it's mostly a pejorative. Civilization and barbarism was something the Romans and the Greeks used to differentiate us and them. It's very similar to the Indian concept of Aryan and Mleka. It doesn't really mean anything outside of that context. A barbarian is just someone with a different culture, different beliefs, and a structure of the way they live their lives. That should not be taken as the same thing as being an utter primitive, like, some African mud hut dwelling person doesn't even know which way is up.
Now we have a comment in the chat here. You're going to love this one. Pseudo Cicero says, low key, any concept of parts of the soul is not Germanic. It's either Greek or Catholic. The Nords didn't develop philosophy of the soul beyond the basic soul-body dichotomy.
I can definitely say that that is absolutely wrong, and I have the citations to prove it. We'll be talking about that earlier or later on.
Yeah. We are going to prove you very wrong, Mr. Pseudo Cicero, and we are going to cite all of our sources, and you are about to get wrecked. So let's move on to the next one here. And this is everybody pay attention. What Pseudo Cicero here is saying is a very common belief among people, and this comes from the demonization of those that wanted to conquer the Germanic peoples of ancient times. They created this meme, this caricature, this straw man, that the Germanics were these uncivilized, stupid, illiterate you know, goofy backwoods idiots that had no concepts or deeper philosophies when it came to souls or your concept of the soul, of spirituality or metaphysics. And it's just blatantly false. It's blatantly false. And we're going to prove it here tonight. So without further ado, let's move on, Mr. Tristan.
Well, actually, before we get into it, I would have to mention that he mentions the basic soul-body dichotomy here. And that's really interesting because the word soul comes from the Germanic word Saul, which is only attested post-Christianization. They didn't have the word for a single unitary soul-like structure, our ancestors. This was something they had to invent in order to interpret the ideas of Christianity.
So it's the other way around.
Yes.
So we had to dumb down what we were thinking in order to understand the new school of thought that was in town.
Well, you know, I wouldn't even say it's so much dumbing it down as it is just a radical departure. As we always like to harp on, the perils of individualism here. When you think about the soul, you really have to imagine that our ancestors viewed themselves irreparably linked to other members of their family, to a clan, to people they were had oaths and bonds to, their king, their chieftains. Mm-hmm. And these all flowed without any sort of obstruction into their concepts of metaphysics and the soul and their place within the divine and spiritual hierarchy of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next on the list, you have the Hugger, right?
Right, the Hugger. And the Hugger is, it is literally thought. The desire and the inclination. People might notice that two of the things here we're talking about today, the Hugger and the Mooner, are represented in Odin's ravens, Hugin and Munin. Mm-hmm. And this is because, unlike many of the sources which simply think these are expressions for poetic natures or something of that sort, we can see that the Hugin and Munin are actually Odin sending out parts of his soul in order to survey the landscape and all of creation.
Yeah, and would you say that this is cognate to maybe the ego?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily cognate to the ego, but in a Freudian sense, but it is very similar. It's certainly of the same sort. I wouldn't say that the lines match up 1-to-1, but 1-to-1.3, something of that sort.
Yeah, and then you have a quote here. Thus ends Loki when he has said his say among the gods. Now I have spoken that which my Hugur urged me to say. Lokasenna.
Right, from the Lokasenna. That's at the end after he's been confronted with Thor. And we see here a common refrain amongst the sources, especially in the sagas, that the Hugur is almost an independent entity within our souls because it has a life beyond ourselves. Part of the Norse conception of the soul embodies patrilineal reincarnation. And the Hugur is one of the aspects that is reincarnated amongst different generations. So the Hugur has an independent nature that is beyond your Mooner, your memory and your personhood, your own personality, your thoughts and memories and that sort of thing. And so we see a common refrain that my Hugur told me this, or my Hugur has urged me to say this, or it tells me this. And from this, we get the understanding that our ancestors believe that the Hugur could communicate its intent to a person in a manner that it would guide you almost.
Yeah, we see this in scientific research as well, that there's two sides of the brain that they are dissecting in certain experiments show that they influence the body and the behavior, that even on a materialist scientific way, we are considered to be multiple beings in one. We are the concept of individualism is just indefensible, whether you're talking from a spiritual standpoint or even a materialist scientific standpoint. Individualism, you being one entity, is just indefensible and just incorrect on all levels.
Right, and we also see this come about in the Völsunga saga when Sigurd Dragonslayer, which is actually this man here, the blonde man blowing the horn with the sword I have as my profile picture, that is the great Sigurd Dragonslayer, the greatest of heroes. When he slays the dragon Fafnir, he's asked, "Why did you do this?" He responds, My Hugel urged me to do it. It urged him towards greatness and glory in the fulfillment of his own destiny.
Yeah. And there's another quote here. It says, Otli Hasteinsson of noble race confidently gives directions to his household after the fight with Hrafn. You, my son, will avenge your father. It will take, if you take after your kin. And my Hugur tells me, Hugur tells me you will become a famous man and your children after you. So that's that even goes with what Mr. Tristan was just saying about how the Hugur will communicate to somebody something. That's pretty fascinating. There's a component within you, within your being, that will communicate to you. And I experience this. I feel like I experience this a lot. I'm sure people in chat have as well.
Oh, absolutely. I experience it all the time. Really, you just have to open yourself to the understanding that what people in modern times would refer to as an intuition, almost, is actually the guiding nature of the Hugur that is trying to lead you on towards what it knows to be correct, because it has much more experience than your own Munar.
That's fascinating. And speaking of Munar, that's the next one we're going to talk about, which is your memory and your personhood. And you say,
right,
cognate to Old English, mine, thought, right, feeling, emotion, desire.
Yes, it's cognate to the Mina, which shows that the concept of this is not just Norse in nature. It has cognates amongst other Germanic languages, showing that it had a very widespread understanding, a very ancient understanding amongst our ancestors. We have to understand that the Munar here, it differs from the Hugur in that it is almost equivalent to what we in modern Western terms would refer to as the soul, that the sense of that it is really you, that, you know, the outside of your physical body, this is you with your thoughts and your feelings and your personality. This would be the Munar, is your memory, your understanding. What makes you you is the Munar.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating.
Now, we could speculate here relating to reincarnation. I don't believe that the Munar is an aspect of the soul that reincarnates after death. I think it journeys on to the various destinations of the afterlife, whether it would be Valhalla or Folkvanger or any of the halls of the gods, or perhaps to Helheim. It is the Munar that stays there, and it becomes you, sort of, where the other aspects of your soul tend to reincarnate on into your kin.
That's fascinating. Agala in the chat says, interesting that Hugin and Munin represent parts of a soul. In Vedic thought, corvids are considered to be souls of the ancestors.
Yes, me and Kerwin have considered very often that the Hindu Pitru Pakti, I'm butchering the translation, actually. It's Pitru Pakti, something of that sort. And it's it happened just a few weeks ago, and it's almost the equivalent of the Germanic Ofabloat. It's where they...
Wow.
Sacrifice and feed ravens in order to give thanks and honor and sustenance to their own ancestors. Wow. A very Germanic holiday.
That sounds very Germanic holiday. That's very cool. Very cool. And, you know, speaking of ancestors and stuff, the next one you have up is the Fylgja. Now, we have the Fylgja, which is a very fascinating concept, and it's actually very multifaceted, but we're going to get into it here. Mr. Tristan, could you explain for us what a Fylgja is?
Yes, I will. And before I continue on what a Fylgja is, I do have to mention that this is mostly my own speculation. I mean, I believe this to be true, and I have evidence to show it, as we'll see here. But other people do have other beliefs about what the Fylgja might represent. And that I'm not going to say that these people are necessarily wrong or that they're stupid or anything of that sort. People I respect have different beliefs about the Fylgja. Uh-huh. But this is what I believe, looking at the evidence, is what the Fylgja is. The Fylgja means literally that which follows, and it is a female Disir. The Disir are the Dis are a type of female propitiatory spirit that is, in this case, linked to the clan, your own ancestors, your tribe, your people. It says here the Disir are explicitly called dead women in Atlamal in the 28th chapter. And a secondary belief that the Disir were the souls of dead women also underlies the Landisir of Icelandic folklore. And from here we get the understanding that the Disir are in fact a sort of female equivalent to the Alfar, that they are the dead ancestors of the clan, the female members of the clan who have married in or remained within it. And instead of reincarnating on, as some males might do, they instead choose to incarnate as a Deesir, to come to Earth, to Midgard, to guide and protect their descendants going forward.
Yeah. Now, I actually have a little bit of a different take on Filgia, as you just said. But I want to remind everybody, if you do have a question for me or Tristan, or you want to comment or whatever, we do have super chats available. If you would like to send us a super chat, or if you enjoy the show and you would like to just send us a little donation, a little tip, if you appreciate what we're doing here, so we can I can upgrade my studio and we get a little bit something for our time here. And we appreciate everybody that does give donations and everything like that. So many thanks to everybody that does. And to anybody that has a question, the super chats are available. But I'm gonna say, with my take on Filgia is actually a little bit different. You mentioned that they are like a female Deesir or a Dees. Dees is literally the lady of a family, like the ladies, the female feminine spirit that is attached to a family. Now, here's my take on it. A Filgia, in my take, now I can't recite the citations off the top of my head, but my take is that the Filgia is when the Dees takes on an animal form.
Right, that is a common representation of the Filgia. I don't believe that it's an entirely different sort of being. I just believe that as they choose to manifest in a certain fashion, they often choose an animal fashion. We do have instances of them also choosing to manifest in a perfectly humanoid feature. Sometimes as a giant woman is also very common.
Yeah, absolutely. So my take, like I said, my take is it that it's a completely different being from a Dees, but that it's like the I guess the animal reflection or the emanation that takes the form of an animal so that we may understand it better. Because as we all know, things in the spiritual world, in the metaphysical world, don't look earthly. They are very, very abstract and bizarre to us, what we tie to earthly formations, earthly manifestations. So a lot of the times when things from the spiritual world or from the metaphysical world come to communicate with us, or we even run into it, not just our minds turning it into something we understand, but they themselves know that they are bizarre to us. This is my gnosis. This isn't in any of the lore that I'm saying, but this is my gnosis on it, that they themselves will take on a form that isn't jarring or shocking to us, which would be like an animal or something like that.
Right. We know from the sources, and especially the sagas, that our ancestors believed that the type of animal your Filgia came about said something about the nature of yourself or your bloodline. Mm-hmm. For instance, very noble people often take an ox or a bear as their Filgia, whereas men who were known to be very radical and headstrong, had something of the wild to them, would have Filgia that was something of sort of like a boar or a wolf. A fox is often a Filgia meant to give the impression of a sort of manipulativeness, a deceitfulness, a wit.
I have my Filgia, I believe, is a bear. And I can't prove that, because they say that you only see your Filgia when you're close to your death. That's like a common belief. But I'm going to tell you, there's a quick anecdotal story. When I was a little kid, my great-grandmother... Now, I don't have any real recollection of my great-grandmother. She passed away before I was even old enough to remember her. But the gift that she gave me when I was a baby was this giant teddy bear. It was like a 3-foot-tall teddy bear, and I called it Big Bear. And it was like my favorite stuffed animal. And I got older. I had a dog that like peed on it real bad and like ripped it apart and like destroyed it. But that was like my favorite stuffed animal ever in like forever. So when I got a little bit older and I started to like come back to spirituality and stuff like that, and I've always had like reoccurring like weird dreams where I saw bears and stuff like that. When I started like getting back into meditation and devotion and prayer, I would sometimes have dreams that I would like be around like a like there'd be a like in my vicinity, I could be like sitting in the woods or whatever, and there'd be this gigantic bear, like a prehistoric cave bear almost. And it would come up and it would like sit. It was like this dream that I had, this big old bear would come to visit me, and I would like talk to it and stuff. It didn't talk or nothing. It was just like a bear would sit there and just like look at me, but I would talk to it. And then in my dreams, I would be like, this is Big Bear. This is the, I associated it with this big stuffed animal that I had when I was a little kid. And that's, you know, I don't know if that's like a real big, profound spiritual thing, but I believe that that's my philia, is like that is this great prehistoric bear. So when my oldest son, for his first birthday, I walked into, it was like I was working crazy hours, my son's first birthday. We were really strapped for money at that time. I just got paid. It was like the day before his birthday. I went to Toys R Us because that was like the only toy store in the area. And I walk into Toys R Us. And I'm like, I got to get this kid something, man. I'm going to feel like a lousy dad if I don't. So I walk into the Toys R Us. And right in front of me, the first thing that I see is this big, giant, stuffed teddy bear on sale, like 50% off. Looked exactly like Big Bear that I had when I was a little kid. So I got my son, my first son, Big Bear. And my first son, I attribute, so I'm getting off on personal stories here. Both times that my wife was pregnant, I pictured my son to be of a certain animal. My first son, I was going to name him Bjorn, but that's like, you know, I mean, we gave him an American name that kind of like means bear. I was like, he's going to be the bear. He's going to be a big, strong kid. He's going to, you know, be like his dad and stuff like that. And you know, I was right. He's got my complexion. He's got my hair. He looks just like me. And he's a monster. He's like 99th percentile size. He's just a big, strong kid. He's just like his dad. He is the bear. So that's kind of like my association with bears and stuff like that. And that's why I believe that it's my field, yeah.
Right, I definitely wouldn't discount that. The bear is one of the most attested filgias that we actually have record of. So it would definitely work.
Yeah, like I said, you know, a lot of these things, you know, we talk a lot about things that need to be verified and things that, you know, need citation and everything like that. But don't get me wrong, there's always room for gnosis and spirituality. There's a difference between religion and spirituality, and somebody that's truly spiritual has both, in my opinion.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you need to have some sort of speculation or personal understanding of the spiritual world, though we should always take care to have the notion that our spiritual ideas are compatible with what we know to be true. You know, otherwise we just, you know, fall off the cliff into Wiccanism.
Yeah, we start sipping on that box wine.
Right, start sipping on the box wine.
Okay. Well, before we go, get too crazy, we got a lot to cover tonight, Mr. Tristan, so...
Right, next is the hominya, which most people will be familiar with. It is one of the most popular parts of the soul. And the hominya is literally the luck of the clan. It's the spiritual essence of a family, a lineage, boiled down and concentrated into power. Power over different aspects of reality, over themselves. You could be lucky in friends, or lucky in war, or lucky in victory. People have luck of all sorts of things. Lucky in farming, lucky in podcasts. Mr. Dave has very much podcast luck here. But I have a quote here from Culture of the Teutons, which I've been using exceptionally in this episode. It's one of my favorite books. I recommend everyone reads it. Cover to cover, absolutely. Everyone should read Culture of the Teutons by Wilhelm Grönbeck. And I will produce a quote here. In the circle of friends, the soul exhibits its features and its strength, but the hominia of the clan is not restricted to that human fence which now encloses the sacred field. The soul is not a thing born with each generation and renewed with each brood of kinsmen that steps in it. It reaches forward. It will, as surely as anything is sure, flow through those sons' sons, which all good kinsmen hope and expect will follow one another. And it reaches back over the known part of the past, embracing all former kin, and extends behind them into the primeval darkness whence their fathers came.
That is so cool.
Yeah, Wilhelm Grönbeck never fails to amaze me. It's a very prescient look into the nature of Germanic culture He actually wrote, he was actually very famous for his ability, almost like a savant in the ability to so empathize with another culture that wasn't him and other different beliefs that he could reproduce this sort of material.
Yeah. So, you
Though
mentioned
I
also,
would like,
go ahead. I'm
oh, go
sorry.
ahead, Dave.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, because you mentioned luck there, the luck of a clan. And in modern times, we very much believe that luck is just like, roll of the dice, just chance.
Right. Luck should not be understood as chance. Luck here should be understood as a sort of power upon reality, something which skews the results in your favor and affects change. So that, for instance, someone with the hamingiyat of victory, like, in, for instance, many kings had great victory hamingiyat, it is almost impossible to face them in battle because their hamingiyat is so overpowering that it spreads across the land and grabs all of the people under its wing and imposes victory because that is its nature. It is not simply a sort of chance, like you flip a quarter or you roll a dice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I actually did a pretty extensive stream one time earlier. I think it's called like Luck and Hamingya or something like that. It's back in my videos somewhere. It's one of my car videos. And I talk about this. Luck is not you just roll of the dice like a lot of people believe. And in the Germanic tradition, luck is viewed as pretty much you're like your accumulated influence on reality that you amass from doing good business, essentially. You do good business long enough, and it works on it's not just a spiritual thing either. It's like it's something that like for example, if you're a good guy and you make good deals with people, word gets around and then everybody's like, oh, this guy, he's a good guy. That's kind of like a thing that goes along with it. And when it gets into the spiritual, if you are a good person, you live a virtuous life and stuff like that, that builds up for you, and then you're gonna have better results moving forward. Obviously, I'm sure everybody knows somebody in their family or in their circles of friends or somebody that they know that's a real scumbag weirdo. And scumbag weirdos always have just a life that is collapsing and chaotic and lousy, and nothing ever goes right for them. Well, that's because they don't have good luck. You know what I mean? It's not luck like chance. It's luck like it's something that has been amassed and accumulated.
And Dave, that's a very good point. I would like to clarify some positions here because some people take it in very strange directions. It should be noted that our ancestors' understanding of metaphysics and the universe was not compatible with an egalitarian outlook into society. They believed that these things were inherited from father to son, passed along different lineages, so that someone who had the hamingiyat for, say, good business, or that were very noble, that they did honorable behavior, they were very noble, they could not simply choose to do ignoble deeds. It their own nobility and the strength of their soul impressed upon them. Their Führer told them how to act and how to behave, so that they simply could not behave in a different fashion. It wasn't a choice for them. And also because of this, they could not simply, someone who was born very low in status, could not simply choose to behave more virtuously and thus accumulate hamingiyat comparable to, say, a great king because of their virtuous behavior. It simply was never possible because, as we say, it wasn't a factor of the egalitarian outlook of our ancestors. People were not equal. It just wasn't the way things worked.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, Mr. Tristan, we are over halfway. What do you say we move on to the next part, talking about the cosmology? Because I know a lot of people. I saw people as soon as we started, they're asking about Valhalla, and I know everybody.
Always a popular one.
That's the popular one. So, and actually first up on the list here. Is there
Right,
anything
it
else you'd
is.
like to add about that, or do you want to? Actually, let's touch on the reincarnation before we get into the cosmology. Does that sound good?
Right, that's what I was going to go for next. Because reincarnation is one of the things I always see. I always get the most pushback towards people who haven't encountered this sort of outlook. They associate it with purely Eastern faiths when this wasn't the case.
Absolutely
I'm
not.
going to quote here from the Vatnsdala saga. When a new man came into the, well, actually, the first part is from the culture of the Teutons, I'm sorry, but he's paraphrasing the Vatnsdala saga. When a new man came into the family, the Northmen said expressly, "Our kinsman is born again, and so has come back." And they confirmed their saying by giving the old name to the young one. Part of the reason they you see Norsemen giving names of different distant relatives to their own children was because they wanted to urge the Hugr and the Hamingja into those new children so that they might have, say, Uncle Peter might come back in this in their son Peter. I will continue here. Thorstein consecrates his son to life with the words, "This boy shall be called Ingemund, and I look for Hamingja for him because of the name. The soul and the luck of old grandfather Ingemund is now to enter into life again, to new activity and the light." Later in the story, we are told that this younger Ingemund brings about the reincarnation of his uncle Jokul by uttering these prophetic words over his second son. "This boy looks as one who will be quick to undertaking. Keen eyes he has. If he lives, he will surely gain the mastery of many and one, and not easy to get on with, but true to friends and kin. A great champion, if my eyes can see. Should we not now call to mind our kinsman Jokul, as my father bade me? Surely he shall be called Jokul." From the Vatnsdala saga.
I love it. I love it. Hey, all of the old texts are just like so epic all the time.
Our distant ancestors sure had a way with words, didn't they?
Absolutely.
It almost effortlessly seems grand and glorious just to read a common casual conversation.
Yeah. Do you think they really talked like that, or do you think it's embellished for the story?
You know, I've noticed before that old Icelandic in the sense of, you know, Old Norse as we're talking here, even to modern Icelandic ears, strikes it as very archaic and grandiloquent and that sort of thing. And it almost sounds equivalent to, say, speaking in Shakespearean English would today. Yeah. It sounds, there's just something about it that sounds bigger than it actually is.
Yeah, it has a certain like gravitas to it.
Yes.
Yeah, very cool. So,
but to move on to Valhalla here.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on reincarnation real quick because reincarnation.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
This is a pretty huge concept and understanding. Because us in the Western world, whether you're come from a secular background, you believe that we're meat machines, or you come from a Christian family and you believe that in like the final destination kind of thing, all religions before the Abrahamic religions believed in reincarnation. Not a single one didn't. Whether we're talking about our tradition and the Germanic tradition, you're talking about the Vedic tradition, you're talking about Buddhism, you're talking all of them believed in reincarnation. And reincarnation can actually also be proved with parapsychology. And I know some people say parapsychology is says that there are holes in it, but there's a lot of evidence to it. There's a lot of evidence to children having memories of past lives, and the talk of past lives has been a thing. You know, there's an entire business in the Victorian era of people trying to find their past lives, having seances and looking into crystal balls and like whatever goofy stuff they were doing to try to find their past lives. We've had this inherent knowledge that we do have past lives all throughout our entire history, because even after the knowledge was gone or swept away or not culturally accepted, we still very much had it in the back of our minds. We knew in our hearts that there was a life after life after life after life. Go ahead.
Well, how could you not when you see, as you were saying here, that your own son, just in this very conversation, he looks so much like you. He reproduces himself in his kin. How could generations of our forebears look at their own children generation after generation and not think that this is my grandfather reborn? This is my uncle. This is my child.
Yeah. And there's certain behaviors, like looking at my sons, there's certain behaviors that they do that just aren't just genetic behaviors. And there's no way they just like watched me do it and they started doing it. They just, like, the one thing that both of my sons do is when I sleep, I put one of my pillows over my face. It's what I do. My son started doing that even when he was still sleeping in his crib before he even saw me ever do that. He started putting his pillow over his face to sleep. And my youngest does that. It's just like a thing that we do. And, it's just like a really weird thing. And we also, when I sleep, I rub my feet together. It's like just some little weird thing that I do. Both of my sons do that. My youngest son is 1.5. There's no way he watched me rub my feet together when I sleep and learned it. And that's not show me in the genome, in the DNA, where, like, feet rubbing in your sleep and putting pillows over your face is somehow some kind of like genetic thing that gets passed down. There's something more to it that these boys had that have that have those quirks. You know what I mean?
Right, and you know, there's been a recent resurgence of Lamarckian genetics, the understanding that people can inherit things that have happened, the experiences of their, you know, their fathers and their grandparents can create a sort of almost like a gene to itself and be passed along into future generations.
That's incredible. Now, I would say that's evidence pointing towards what we're talking about with it, which is the metaphysical side of things, the spiritual reincarnation, and not just, you know, if you get into something like the newer kind of stuff. I'm a big fan of Edgar Cayce, who was a mystic. Edgar Cayce was huge into reincarnation. He was, you know, just for everybody who's not familiar with Edgar Cayce was called the Sleeping Prophet. He had over 14,000 readings, and not a single one of them has ever been disproven. He's the most accurate prophet, you know, most accurate mystic of all times. And one of his biggest things that he would talk about was reincarnation. He talked about it so much that he was declared a heretic by the Christians of the time. So, you know, there's a lot that goes in with reincarnation. And it's just, in my mind, there's no way that it's not true.
Oh, absolutely. I 100% believe this to be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I have somebody in the chat says epigenetic memories. That's just not enough. And the genetic code, it just isn't going to save full memories and behaviors like that. There's something more to it. There's something more to it than just this, like the materialist understanding of it.
Well, we have to keep in mind that just because we can see a materialist explanation for something, such as epigenetic genes and their influences here, doesn't mean that this is not also principally metaphysical. One of the main arguments for a metaphysical idea to consciousness is that the brain acts as a sort of radio receiver, and it picks up the consciousness from a metaphysical realm. Just because something physically exists doesn't disprove the spiritual component.
Yeah. I've quoted this quite a few times because I think it's a really fascinating thing, but an interviewer one time asked Nikola Tesla, how do you come up with all of these brilliant ideas? And he said, they're not my ideas. He said, I'm just a conduit and I receive them from the ether, is what he was describing.
You know, I believe that that idea about the notion that we receive creative ideas from the ether, from a platonic realm, and they don't really belong to us, as very prominent among different media like movies and TV shows and books. I don't believe that, for instance, Tolkien actually wrote The Lord of the Rings. I believe he was receiving this information from somewhere else. And it's the same for other authors that have that inspired sort of creation. Yeah.
Sure. Man, when I'm typing and I'm writing something for my games or for my whatever I'm doing, I literally feel that what Nikola Tesla was describing, that it's my mind is just going on its own. I'm opened up and I'm accepting the creativity from another realm. And what we would call this the meat of inspiration, right?
Yes, Jung actually talks about the idea quite frequently. He terms it ergreifen in German, which is to be seized, in the context of Odin seizes a person and imbues them with a poetic inspiration. We often talk about, in these circles, we often talk about the Führer Teutonicus, the berserk rage, but what's often left out is the Führer Poeticus, the divine inspiration that comes from Odin.
Yeah, absolutely. And we could do a whole show talking about the meat of inspiration and all that stuff. There's so much to it, and how it transcends just Germanic tradition. It's found in many, many other cultures and traditions. But we're gonna move on to, finally, we're gonna talk about some Valhalla. What do you think, Tristan?
Oh, finally, everyone, we're gonna talk about Valhalla now. Your wishes have been granted.
So let's talk about Valhalla. What are the, you know, a lot of people think it's like, oh, it's Viking heaven or whatever. Everybody goes there. Only people that get slayed in battle and like stuff like that. And I actually wanted to bring up one argument that our colleague, Mr. Mark Pereer, talks about. He says, you know, here's the thing about Valhalla. Like, what do you, there's this conception that if you just go and you die in battle, you go to Valhalla. Well, he asked the question, and this is him being critical of the idea, and that is that, say, like, somebody that's, like, a farmer or whatever that's never fought in their life, and they get raided, and they pick up a weapon, and they go and they charge in the battle, and they fight, and they, you know, kill one guy, and then they get killed. Do they go to Valhalla over somebody like Sun Tzu, who's like a great strategist that may never have actually fought anybody before, and he died of old age, even though his battle plans, you know, slayed countless thousands of people?
Well, I think there's something to be said about the nature of them dying in battle, because we have several instances of Odin betraying people that he had previously supported, and even appearing as a theophany himself, literally physically appearing inside of a battle in order to kill a great enemy or a great friend in some cases.
Yeah.
So there is something to be said about the actual nature of them dying in battle. But I would have to go back to the notion I've said before about how our ancestors didn't conceive of the universe in an egalitarian sense. The modern liberal understanding of egalitarianism is simply incompatible with our ancestors' worldview.
Uh-huh.
That Valhalla isn't for everyone. I'm sorry if everyone decided they wanted to go to Valhalla, but I mean, chances are you're never going to make it. This is encapsulated most spectacularly in Saxo Grammaticus, where he has the hero Bjarki tell us that Odin is seizing for doom no lowly obscure race, no cheap rabble souls, but enmeshes the rulers and fills his river below with men of fame.
Yeah.
Now, we have to consider here that the Germanic caste system is a very real thing. We have thralls and carls and jarls, right? Odin is interested in taking the jarls, those people who have great nobility, the strength of their familia, and he is only interested in these people. He is not interested in your metaphor or your notion there of the farmer who's never fought anyone before and suddenly he dies in battle when he's going to Valhalla. Odin would reject this person because it's not what he's after. He's not after just people who die in battle. He's not after quantity. He's after quality.
Mm-hmm. Not saying that man that fought bravely isn't going to be rewarded.
You know, certainly. He could be rewarded for his own virtuous conducts, as we'll see later in the various afterlives. But Valhalla is not an option for most people.
Now, somebody in the chat mentioned something, and I want to point it out real quick. Bear or something says, they've administered tests in sequence in different countries randomly. They found that each time the test was administered, the average score increased, hinting that we are connected somehow. I want you to check out morphogenic fields. Morphogenic fields is an area of, it's a kind of an obscure area of science. Morphogenic fields, bioelectricity, stuff like that. Look it up and compare that to our concept of folk consciousness. And I think you're going to find something really, really cool. So back to Valhalla.
Right. This can also be seen in the Lay of Harbarth, in which Harbarth taunts Thor with the sentence here, Odin's are the nobles who fall in battle, but Thor are the thralls. And by this he means that Odin keeps his own sons in Valhalla, or only the nobles. He doesn't keep common folk in Valhalla. Mm. But Thor does. He keeps thralls. All the thralls who die go to Thor in his hall, where he guards and protects them. And he was making a sort of taunting motion to Thor because of saying this, that he must be also of a lesser nature. Of course, that's ridiculous, but we could go into an entire discussion about the Lay of Harbarth.
Now, I see a few people asking, and we're starting to run out of time, but I want to hit everything we want to do, but I want to answer these questions real quick. Both these people ask, Agala again asks, what's the criteria to go to Folkvang? And then White Rider asks, what are the different realms that you go to when we die? If we don't go to Valhalla, do we still find peace?
Yes, there are different realms here. We'll be going to a couple of them. This is what we'll be talking about next.
So next up you have Alfar.
Right. One of the next possible afterlives for people is to be accepted as one of the Alfar, one of the revered ancestors. It should be noted that there seems to be a couple different types of Alfar. There are the Alfar who were born Alfar, that they're, you know, the elves, they represent almost like minor divinities of natural concepts of that sort. They live in Alfheim, but some of the Alfar are great revered ancestors who have been lifted up to this almost semi-divine state. We have here a quote here about Olaf Gerstadolf, which I believe I mentioned last episode of the Bog, and I'll quote it here. The author recounts that Olaf called a ting on his farm to tell people about a dream he had had, in which a black bull that came through the country killing a lot of people, and at last it killed Earl Olaf's herd, which is his huskarl. Olaf thought that this dream was a warning of disease and famine coming. He therefore asked the people at the ting to make a great mound where they could bury him after his death. Everything happened as Olaf had said. Sickness and mass death happened, and his herd died, and finally himself, and he was buried in a mound on Gierstad. And now we have the quote here from a poem. Long while this branch of Odin's stem was the stout prop of Norway's realm, long while King Olaf with just pride ruled over Vestfold far and wide, at length by cruel gout oppressed, the good King Olaf sank to rest. His body now lies under the mound, buried at Gierstad in the mound.
Beautiful.
We see here he was afterwards worshipped as the elf of Gierstad, the Gierstad elf, and thought to bring a protection and prosperity to his people by doing so. And this is actually a very long tradition, of especially amongst the House of Inglingar, those people who are descended from the god Freyr. As we know, Freyr rules over Alfheim. Freyr himself was entombed in a mound, and this is a very common afterlife for especially the Inglingar. We can see here that one of the possible afterlives is to be accepted as one of the Alfar. To be, when you bury them inside of a mound, they stay amongst the people, amongst our descendants and the people in their community, and they can protect them as a sort of divine spirit, almost like a very beneficial draugr in a sense.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. That's a great take. So next on the list, we have Helheim.
Right, Helheim here is, we know Helheim is located under us in the north direction. It is cold and misty, and there are often references to having to pass over a river. Sometimes it's a normal river, and sometimes it's considered a river full of clanging weaponry. We know it is guarded by the hound Garmr, which will eventually slay Tyr at Ragnarok. I believe the Helheim is cognate to the Greek fields of Asphodel. And it is sort of a bland, lifeless place in which most people go after they die. People who are unfortunate enough not have been chosen by one of the gods to fulfill a certain special afterlife. These are just normal people. Your average person goes to Helheim. It's not a punishment. It's not like the Christian hell where they're being tortured or anything. In Helheim, people most likely pursue the same sort of things they did in other life. You know, they sleep, they eat, they go to bed, they hunt, that sort of thing. They just also do it in a different realm.
And in Helheim is, people are asking about Folkvang. Folkvang exists within Helheim.
Well, see, I wouldn't agree with that. I would not agree with the notion that Folkvang exists within Helheim. I think that's a parallel to the Valhall as a sort of political mediation between the Vanir and the Æsir.
So, what is your take on Helheim? Is it a place of peace and happiness? Is it just kind of like you just continue life there, or is it somewhere that you go see your family again?
Well, I mean, all of the above, really. It really depends. Helheim would depend on exactly how you make of it. People who lived a terrible life as they did here are going to live a terrible life in Helheim. People who lived a grand life with lots of family are going to live such a life in Helheim as well. It is very much a cold, dark reflection of our own living world.
But it is a place of peace, correct?
Oh, yes, it is a place of peace. There's not a... People aren't going to be re-killed in Helheim. It's not like they're going to be tortured or diseased or anything of that sort. It is, in fact, almost like a final resting place.
White Rider asks, is there a path from those in Helheim to reach Valhalla, upward mobility?
There is a notion that we have here that most people, or at least all people, might go to Helheim, at least for a short time. Perhaps some of the gods use it as a sort of a gathering spot for all of the souls, and then they come and retrieve you after a certain amount of time. But there is no real hard evidence for that. It's just speculation. We have to we consider the evidence and say that it doesn't really say. Helheim is unfortunately has a sparsity of evidence because Snorri, who is our primary source on the matter, has conflated it very heavily with Christianity.
So moving on is you were talking about the area of punishment. You brought up Nastrond. And before we get into Nastrond, I want to ask, how is Nastrond different than Niflhel?
Well, Niflhel is a geographic location within the Nine Worlds. Helheim lies outside of Niflhel, but Niflhel is a location near Helheim. It's outside of the borders of Helheim, specifically relegated to Great Sinners.
And how is it, and would you say that Nastrond is on the shores of Niflhel?
Yes, Nastrond is a specific location within Niflhel.
And I see people in the chat saying that they're not looking forward to Helheim, and it's a place of boredom and mediocrity and stuff like that. What would you say about that, Tristan?
Well, I would say that there are certainly greater heights to achieve. If you could, for instance, choose between Valhalla and Helheim, I, for one, would choose Valhalla, or perhaps any of the Halls of the Gods over Helheim. But you should also remember that almost everyone you have ever met will be in Helheim. I mean, to say that you don't want to go to Helheim is to say that you don't care about your friends and your family and your children. I mean, it's a very selfish sort of understanding.
Yeah, it's and I wouldn't like necessarily because it's a little bit jarring when you think about the description. But you also got to think that, like I said before, things that are metaphysical are very, are a lot different than what we understand. They don't manifest how we understand them. So when you read about Helheim and they're talking about a place that's, I believe my boy Jamie said, half dreadful, half beautiful. It's like dreadful doesn't necessarily mean scary or bored or gross.
You know, the word I would use to describe Helheim is bittersweet.
So it's certainly a good place. It's a place that there's not going to be any pain or corruption or evil. It's a place of just serene bliss that you go to until it's your time to be reborn. And this is a realm that gets described in many, many, many traditions.
Absolutely. One shouldn't be allowed to conflate it with the notion of the Christian hell as a sort of punishment. And I keep reiterating this because it's such a hard baked in idea for modern people to understand hell as a place of punishment, a place you never, ever want to go. And that's not the case in the Germanic tradition. Helheim is perfectly fine.
It's a good spot where everybody here is probably going to Helheim. So, I'll see you guys there. I'm looking forward to it because I have so many wonderful family members that passed away before I got old enough to get to know them and stuff. And I really look forward to seeing them again and hearing their wisdom. And, you know, I look forward. I mean, obviously I have plenty of things to do here in life. You know what I mean? But when it's my time to move into the next life, I'm not scared at all, and I'm ready to do it. And obviously, it's going to be sad and it's scary because you're leaving this world. And change is always scary, but you know it's part of existence is the journey of the soul. And when you get to that place, it's going to be a place that doesn't have, you know, I'm not going to be dealing with all these corrupt politicians and all this garbage and degeneracy in the media. It's a place of peace. And
I would hope we get a very good outlook over Nastrond where we can see all these corrupt politicians.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of Nastrond, let's get on to that.
Right. Nastrond, I will quote here from the Gylfaginning. On Nastrond is a great hall in evil, its doors face to the north. It is all woven of serpent backs like a wattle house, and all the snake heads turn into the house and blow venom, so that along the hall runs rivers of venom, and they who have broken oaths and murderers wade those rivers. and also from the Voluspa. She saw their waiting onerous streams, men perjured and wolfish murderers, and the one who seduces another close trusted wife. There Neathhogger sucked corpses of the dead, the wolf tore men. And for here we can see that, contrary to a lot of modern understandings, we do in fact have a sort of damnation and a sort of punishment for sin in the Germanic tradition. People who break oaths, who murder their own people, who commit adultery. These are three great crimes which the gods abhor, and they will judge you iniquitous and send you to be consumed in Nastron by Neathhogger. Neathhogger is a great dragon. We can see his name comes from the term Neath, the sort of sin, as we discussed it, the eater of the sins.
Yeah, absolutely. And many people would argue that the idea of having a torturous afterlife for evil people comes from our tradition, because in the early Abrahamic views, you just like there is like what was it called, Sheol or whatever in Judaism, where it's pretty much just a place of nothingness. They called it just mass grave. They didn't even it like literally just means the mass grave. They didn't really have like afterlife. And you know, when you look at Indo-European tradition, every Indo-European tradition is very, very big on you know, giving people what they deserve. You know what I mean?
Right. It shows up all over the place. The Greeks have Tartarus and Elysium as a sort of a contrary point, a sort of paradise. Tartarus is for the punishment. The Hindus have it as well, a sort of an underworld in which sinners and great enemies of the gods are punished for their vile misdeeds. It is a very Indo-European worldview.
Yeah. So Nastrond, now this is a word that comes from Snorri, right?
Yes, the actual term Nastrond does come from Snorri.
How much validity do you put into that word?
I mean, it's hard to say exactly if the word itself, this Nastrond, Strand of the Dead, is true. I think it's likely to be correct, because it's so... We have the exact same sort of thing quoted in Voluspa, which Snorri did not write. Snorri did not write the Voluspa.
Yeah.
And it also compares very favorably with his take on Nastrond. So I think it's reasonable to assume it's fairly close.
And this is a realm for all the scumbags. This is where lousy, evil, scumbag, jerk-off people go to, and they have a really, really bad time. Now, if you read all in the story, it talks about snakes devouring you. You get
right, that's
apart.
In Fergelmir, is when a great pool in which snakes live in the waters and will devour you.
Yeah. Now, I have this also, you know, I'm a scientific-minded guy. I'm an abstract creative thinker. And I also understand metaphysics. Would you say that it's literally what this describes? Or would you say that this is just our kind of our ancestors' earthly description of what they saw and understood?
I believe that this, if you do this in a sense that you're a great horrible person and die, this is literally what you will experience. But that is not to say that this does not also have a sort of a metaphorical implication, that, you know, the metaphysics mean something, the serpents devouring you and the streams of the perjurers and that sort of thing. It's both. It is literally what you're going to experience, but it also means something more, something higher on the bedrock of reality.
Yeah. And, man, I've told the story multiple times. I'm going to tell the whole thing over again, but I've had experiences where, you know, and I had a near death experience, and I experienced a place of great discomfort and suffering and stuff like that. And I don't, man, you can just go read near death experiences and stuff. I've had friends that were like, you know, atheists. I just have one friend in particular who was a staunch atheist, and he's actually now starting to get into the Germanic tradition stuff, but early on, you know, me and him, we didn't have a great lifestyle, and he overdosed on drugs. And I mean, I wasn't as bad as him. Like, I wasn't into the really bad drugs, but he was doing a lot of nasty stuff, and he overdosed, and he saw a place of great suffering and torment, And he's like, I'm, you know, it made him spirit, it completely changed his life around. He never like started going to church or anything like that. He still kind of maintained this kind of like agnostic thing. But what he saw on the other side terrified him. And, you know, and every tradition has it. And to think that there isn't a realm of great torment and punishment for evil souls is just ludicrous, in my opinion.
I find that rather interesting that his experience didn't put the fear of God into him. It put the fear of morality into him.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that. That's a very succinct way of putting it. Very cool.
So now we're going to move on to the different halls of the gods, which I believe are possible afterlives for people who meet the requirements for their entry. Now, I must note that it is sort of speculative about what these requirements might actually be. We don't have any real information. We can logically infer that to become a resident of one of the halls of the gods, it might be that the god specifically chooses you to come into there for some reason. Perhaps you fulfill, you know, you are professionally a member of one of the things they do. Like, Uller is the god of huntsmen. Maybe if you were a great hunter, you get to go to Uller's Hall. Maybe sailors get to go to Njord's Hall. That is one of the possible ideas here. I do think it's definitely true that the halls of the gods are a possible afterlife for people, but we don't know exactly how you get there.
So we're going to go through. I know you have some of the in our show notes here. You have some pretty good examples of the different gods that have halls. At least that's represented in our texts. You mentioned Uller, who is the god of the hunt, who actually in the Dutch tradition and in the tradition that's found in here in good old Pennsylvania called Erklave, he's called the Jägermeister. The Jägermeister in like the Alpine tradition is like one of their most beloved deities because, you know, they do so. As we all know, I'm sure everybody's heard of like hunting lodges in Switzerland and the Swiss Alps and stuff like that. The Jägermeister, which is, you know, what the booze is named after, is Uller, same guy, same god. So that's, I just wanted to throw that out there. But the next one you have is Balder, right?
Right, Balder. It says here the seventh is Breithablik. Balder has there for himself a dwelling set in the land I know that lies so fair and from evil fate is free. So it seems that if you go to the Hall of Balder, it is a very pleasant area where there is no evil. That is what we know about Breithablik, where Balder lives.
That's wonderful. That sounds beautiful. And, you know, judging by Balder being like Odin's solar son, he was the radiant one, the most beautiful one. I can only imagine that his place is absolutely.
I would imagine it to be very close to popular descriptions of heaven.
Absolutely. Next up on the list, we're gonna push through these a little bit quicker because we're over time. So we're gonna go over to Heimdall.
Heimdall. Himinbjorg is the eighth, and Heimdall there, or men who hold sway, it is said. In his well-built house does the water of heaven the good mead gladly drink. There we can see that Heimdall has lots of men in his hall that he holds sway over, and they like the party. They drink mead in Heimdall's hall.
That sounds fun.
So it sounds like a great place.
Yeah, I like that. I'll go there.
And next we have Freya. The ninth is Folkvang, where Freya decrees who shall have seats in the hall. The half of the dead each day does she choose, and half does Othin have. So we can see here, as I mentioned before, I think Folkvanger is a sort of political compromise with the Vanir, that Odin's Valhall gets half of the noble slain, and Freya in Folkvang also gets half.
Yeah, and Jamie Martin, I want to mention this, our boy Jamie Martin, who's big into the Saxon stuff, he has a really cool quote from Beowulf. Many marvelous sea monsters harried them while diving with sharp tusks, attacking his battle sark, terrible beast tearing. Then the noble warrior saw that he was in some sort of Nithsela. And Nithsela is like Niflhel.
That is a great quote there. As we mentioned earlier, the casual language of our ancestors is just glorious to behold.
Beautiful, beautiful stuff. And then next up on the list, you have Njord.
Right, Njord. The Elamathus Noatun there has Njorth for himself a dwelling set. The sinless ruler of men there sets in his temple timbered high. See, Njord is one of the deities that we know was worshipped quite extensively, but we don't have very much information on, unfortunately. It just references scattered here and there we can piece together. We know that Njord was the king of Sweden, or the Svithjod, before Freyr was and passed it on to him. He was what are of the Yngling line in that sense. And he is also called the Prince of Temples. Njord was one of the original priests that Odin set up for the gods. So we know that he is a very priestly man, as it says here, the sinless ruler of men.
Wow. And also, it says 11th is Noatun. His hall is called Noatun. That kind of sounds like Neptune. Do you think there's any sort of connection?
I'm not sure if there is a connection with the actual linguistics, though if I do remember correctly, Noatun refers to a sort of a covering where people would keep their ships on land. So perhaps it does, because I know Neptune derives from the idea of being hidden. So maybe that is something there.
Wow, Big Dave found a cognate.
Right.
Okay, so yeah, that's really, really, really great stuff. And then you have one more section here in the notes that we can...
Right,
we can
the last one we're going to talk about here is one of the Halls of the Gods, is Aesir's Hall with Ran, which is a very... It's almost unfortunate in comparison. Many people dislike going to Ran's Hall. Chapter 33 of Skaldskaparmal discusses why Skalds may refer to gold as Aesir's fire. The section traces the Kinane to a narrative surrounding Aesir, in which the Jotun employs glowing gold in the center of his hall to light it like fire, which the narrator compares to flaming swords in Valhalla. That tells us two very important things, that Aesir's hall is lit by glowing gold and is underwater, which sounds rather cool if I may say so, but also that there are flaming swords in Valhalla, because if you didn't need it to be any more metal.
Hell. That sounds awesome. And then he says, greatly has Ran afflicted me. I have been despoiled of a great friend. Empty and unoccupied, I see the place which the sea has torn my son.
Right, and that's from Aegil's Lament. It seems our ancestors believed that if you were to be killed at sea, that Ran would catch you in her net and take you to her hall with Aesir. Our ancestors very much did not like Ran for... It seems she was a very hostile person. Aesir, though, appears to be an ally to the gods, though. As we noted in the Norana chat, some people have different takes on the matter.
Yeah.
I will quote here the last from Frithjof's saga. The red ring here I hew me, once owned of Halfdan's father, the wealthy lord of Irwal. Here the sea waves undo us, so on the guests shall gold be. If we have need of guesting, meet so for mighty menfolk amid Ran's hall to hold them.
Beautiful. Such beautiful words. And somebody in the chat says, I can't help but feel we are lesser men than our ancestors in all ways.
See, because we have the understanding of the reincarnation here, we are not lesser men than our ancestors. We are the same men as our ancestors.
All right, I like that. That makes me feel a lot better. Because we read these stories about our ancestors and how awesome they were and how resilient and brave and courageous and virtuous and awesome they were. And it's like today you look around and, I mean, I'm sure in our ancestors' times there was plenty of scumbags around, but they couldn't operate like they can now. They had they faced social scrutiny and they were punished for their behavior, and we had great,
All right, well, 1,000 years ago, if you said something bad to someone, they hit you with a sword. That limited bad behavior. It was a natural limitation there.
Yeah, but we are in practice, in reality, we are, I believe, lesser than our ancestors. However, we are our ancestors. At the same time, we still have much of the capability and potential that they do. And keep this in mind, that say we even are lesser, completely lesser, and just like pieces of crap compared to our ancestors, very, very soon. You know, as we're describing today, and as in the wisdom left in the ancient texts left by our ancestors, we know that we will go to, this is what we're talking about all night long, we will be going to another place after this life. And then after that life, we will be reborn again, reincarnation. And then we'll have another chance. We'll be reborn in a new age with new wisdom and new knowledge. And we'll have another chance to be maybe even greater than the stories that were left behind by our ancestors.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dave, if people think that we are lesser than our ancestors, and that really bugs us, that we think that we could look back on our great forebears and see how great they were. Why don't we take the wisdom of our forefathers here? When you have a child, when you have a son, name them after one of the heroes of old so that he might reincarnate in our own child to bless our kid once more.
Oh, yeah, I love that. Cause that's a bit, that was a big practice, is you would name your child something because you wanted to attract that specific ancestor from the other world to come inhabit the body of your child, right?
Yes, that's exactly how it worked.
That's absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. All right, Mr. Tristan, we did go over like 20 minutes, but it was okay because this is a very important episode, and it was a really, really good episode. And this is
we had a lot to cover, but it's definitely good to get it covered.
Absolutely. This is a question, you know, at the beginning of the show, I said this is something that got overlooked a lot by, like, you know, previous, you know, pagan or heathen or also true or Odinist or whatever, you know, movements or organizations or people or what have you. The overall community and, you know, also true as a whole has overlooked this because, like, oh, we're scared of sounding Christian with having believing in afterlife and stuff, when it's clear as day in the text, it's clear as day in the evidence, it's clear as day that our ancestors believed this, and they overlooked it. So now, as we're coming out of the secular wolf age, as we're coming out of that, we are very much like, we have these questions once again, and that's something I get asked all the time, is where do we go when we die? Or, like, they'll have a family member that passes, unfortunately, like a father or grandfather, or even, like, you know, man, in the wolf age, so many unfortunate deaths because of opiets and, like, all this. I'm not even going to get into it. You guys already know. It's horrible. It's an epidemic. I've lost so many friends. Some of my best friends have passed away because of this. So, and I know a lot of you guys have experienced this pain too, and the suffering too. And so many other people have come to me with this stuff, and they ask, they say, you know, am I going to be able to see these people again? And our ancestors left it behind for us. It's right here, man. It's right here. In these texts, our ancestors tell us, you will see these people again. You know, it's not the end of the world. The humanist, secularist, modern, postmodern crap school, this no materialist school of thought, the anus worship school of thought, has taught you that you're a meat machine and that after you die, it's over, you black out and there's nothing left. That's completely false. Completely false. You have a life after this one and a life after that one. And we will see our beloved dead once again. And, you know, it's just, this is the truth, the wisdom that was left behind for us.
I would even go further and say that the old family members, like your grandparents and your great-grandparents that you might miss after they pass away, you can take knowledge that they can be reborn in your own kin. Perhaps they will show up as your children or your grandchildren.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so when you accept this knowledge, it's really hard to, after you come out of the secular wolf age, to once again take on this knowledge that this is the reality, that this is what happens, and this is what our ancestors believed for thousands of years. Forever our ancestors believed this. And they not that believed it, they knew it. And it's only been a very short period of time that we've believed in secular materialism.
You know, Dave, it's often interesting when I see people think about like how long our ancestors actually believed this sort of thing. We know that this is common amongst all of the Indo-European traditions, which means it had to have been part of the earth or not. And that means that our ancestors must have believed this for 4, maybe 5,000 years. And we can only go back that far because that's when history ends. We don't have any records before that because people didn't even have letters to record anything with. That's how far back our ancestors still believe this as an authentic continuation of their knowledge.
They literally believed it since we have record of it, and most certainly before.
Absolutely. The first records we have, our ancestors, this was old news to them.
Yeah, that says something. That says something. That's incredible. And as I said before, you know, this is in every single tradition. It's not just our tradition. This knowledge is in all traditions. And this knowledge is liberating. When you realize that you're not a meat machine, when you realize that there is life after this life, it liberates you from so many pains and so much suffering and so many of these shackles of anguish that the materialist world, the post-industrial world, the modern world has placed upon our souls. It breaks those shackles and liberates you, and you are able to live a life that is much more peaceful.
Absolutely. That is a very beautiful way to put it, Dave.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Tristan, we are going to shut it down for this evening. Do you have anything in closing?
No, I don't believe. I believe I covered everything here. I'm good.
Wonderful. All right, so everybody, make sure you like, subscribe, share here on the Dave Martell channel. Click the little bell so you can get an alert every time we go live, every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. And also make sure you go over to Mr. Tristan's new website up for his organization with him and Mr. Kerwin, our good friend, at ariakasha.com, ariakasha.com. And also check out me and Tristan. We're colleagues over at the Nirona Society, nirona.org. Both organizations are absolutely wonderful, great. You will absolutely love all of the work and content that we create in these two organizations. It's really, really great. We work overtime. Dozens of us, dozens. We're talking tons of people. All the biggest brains of our folk are gathering together. This is literally, those two organizations are like Mensa. They're like folkish Mensa. That's really what it is. And we put our hearts and our souls, blood, sweat, and tears into discerning the texts, bringing about all of the ancient knowledge and wisdom and culture and tradition that we forgot. You know, people say that we lost it. We didn't lose it. We just forgot it. And now we're starting to remember. As I say all the time, the gods never stop speaking to us.
The gods did not forget our tradition.
No, we forgot. And now we're remembering. And now we're reaching a new golden age. So everybody, I'll see you guys next week. I'll check you out then. Much love and many blessings to all you guys. I'll see you guys next week. Hail the gods, hail the folk, hail victory, and hail to each and every one of you and your wonderful, beautiful families. Good night, everybody. Take care.